intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled, Gimme Shelter, by Douglas Starr. Inside America's largest sanctuary for rescued pets, and its controversial quest to save them all. In 1982, a balding, bearded guy named Francis Batista drove through a canyon outside of Kanab, Utah, in a battered blue hatchback. He gazed up at the majestic red walls rising from the lowlands of junipers and pines. It's magical, he thought. Lowering his eyes, he saw a locked gate with a sign, $3 for a tour map. He paid the woman nearby. The gate belonged to a ranch, and on an impulse, Batista asked the woman if the land might be for sale. Sure might, she replied. The area had once been a popular filming location for westerns. The TV series Gunsmoke had been shot nearby, as had many movies. And the property's owners, a group of businessmen from Kanab, had been running a tour business. But it wasn't going so well, and some of the stakeholders wanted to unload the property. Excited, Batista drove back to a homestead in Arizona he shared with 26 friends and 200 dogs, cats, bunnies, burros, and birds. Batista and his friends belonged to a new religion called the Foundation Faith of God. The faith's founder was originally a Scientologist who broke off from the church and added elements of Christian millennialism and psychotherapy. The group ministered to children's hospitals, prisons, poor neighborhoods, and other places where they believed they could offer physical, mental, and spiritual help. It was all about how we get in touch with the angels in our lives, Batista told me. Batista and his cohort were in charge of an animal rescue ministry. They were a motley group. Architects, Oxford and Cambridge graduates, artists, writers, college dropouts, an engineer, a CPA, a real estate agent, a Harris, a British stage actress, and an Afro-Cuban bass player who chipped in to buy the small ranch in Arizona on behalf of the Foundation Faith. After taking in a couple hundred animals, they ran out of space, which motivated Batista to go looking for more. By 1984, the group had scraped together enough money for a down payment on the ranch in Utah, and they moved in with their 200 adopted pets. Throughout the decade, as they focused on building what would become the Best Friends Animal Society, the religious group began to dissolve. The Foundation Faith ran its course, Batista told me recently. Everything was being oriented around the animals. Today, Best Friends is a secular organization that runs the country's largest sanctuary for neglected and abused pets, as well as a national network of like-minded shelters. Its property in Utah covers nearly 6,000 acres and houses around 1,600 animals, including dogs, cats, horses, pigs, bunnies, and birds. It's so big it has neighborhoods, Dogtown, Cat World, Horse Haven, and others. Each animal gets individual medical and emotional care, ideally becoming healthy enough to be placed in a private home. More than 300 employees are joined there each year by 6,000 volunteers and 40,000 visitors, some of whom stay for weeks to play with and care for the animals. The place has become such a popular tourist attraction that the managers bought and refurbished a derelict hotel in town and a fleet of vans to transport animals and people. But Best Friends has also become a source of controversy. The group was among the earlier animal welfare organizations to come out against the widespread shelter practice of killing animals to relieve chronic overcrowding. Its call to action is direct. Together, we can save them all. Increasingly, Best Friends has taken this goal nationwide, funding training programs, embedding its staff inside struggling shelters elsewhere, and offering grants to those that share its visions. In the process, Best Friends has become a major voice in the national conversation about animal welfare, along such groups as the Humane Society and the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Yet critics argue that its tactics are uncompromising and sometimes counterproductive. I give them a lot of credit for pushing the industry beyond its comfort zone. Julie Levy, an expert in shelter medicine education at the University of Florida, told me. But sometimes those strategies backfire, and you have to step back and try a different method. Julie Castle, the society's CEO, responded to the criticism by reiterating the group's guiding principle. Our pets are our best friends. Why should we be killing them? The Red Rock region of southern Utah has seen a lot of residents over the years. Early inhabitants included ancestral Pueblobians who dwelt there thousands of years ago and carved mysterious petroglyphs on the rock walls. A Spanish expedition came through in 1776, looking for a trade route between Santa Fe and Monterey. A century later, 10 Mormon families arrived and established the present town of Kanab. Then came the movie-making days of the early 20th century. By the time the animal sanctuary arrived, those days were largely over and the canyon was quiet. Cyrus Maya, a co-founder and board member of the group, recalled his first impressions of the ranch. There was nothing, he said. No infrastructure, no roads, no electricity, no telephone. The friends pooled their funds, got a couple of donated trailers, and started building a bunkhouse. They used do-it-yourself manuals to teach themselves construction. There's a good-hearted debate among the founders about whether they used a Reader's Digest or Time Life Guide. They hired a local man to help them dig wells. Their plan was to take in animals that had run out of chances and would otherwise be killed. We wanted to give them space and time to heal, Maya said. Soon animals started coming in. People would bring an unwanted pet. Local law enforcement would drop off a few strays. Everything changed after one dog ran away from the sanctuary and turned up at the local pound. The sanctuary members found it to be a grim tin roof cell block, boiling in the summer and freezing in the winter. A vet would come once a week and put down any unadopted creatures. Here was a prime example of the problem, right on their doorstep. Batista spoke to the mayor of Kanab, explaining that he and his friends were new to the area, had limited land, and would be happy to take over animal control. Sure, said the mayor. It's just a tiny town, thought Batista and his friends. How bad could it be? They quickly found out. The animal control district stretched beyond Kanab. It included all the towns and counties in the area, encompassing thousands of square miles. When word got out that a bunch of hippies were adopting animals, the critters came pouring in. Strays, invaders, victims of hoarding, and pets that the owners could no longer take care of. One time someone called us to see about some cats under their trailer, Batista said. By the time we got out of there, we had 65 cats. From the beginning, Batista and his friends were committed to doing things differently from conventional pounds, which had their roots in the mid-19th century and were established to protect the public's health. Pounds initially served as depots where stray dogs presumed to carry rabies were rounded up to be executed. Yes, it was cruel, but it was an improvement over letting people shoot or club dogs in the streets. In the 1930s and 1940s, rabies vaccines for dogs became widely available, reducing the threat. The population crisis began to ease in the 1970s thanks to low-cost spaying and neutering. Cultural shifts also played a role, as people began to see pets as family members and became less likely to abandon them. Still, America's shelters were so overrun that they killed at least 13.5 million cats and dogs per year, according to the Humane Society. Best Friends adamantly opposed this approach. It is committed to rehabilitating every animal it possibly can, only putting down creatures a vet has deemed beyond rehabilitation. When it comes to animals that are simply taking up space or need more time to heal, Best Friend argues that euthanasia is a weasel word. It prefers the frank and direct word kill. Because of this philosophy, it didn't take long for Best Friends to have 2,000 animals, far more than the number of humans coming to adopt them. Money ran short. In danger of having their animals starve, not to mention going hungry themselves, the founders started begging, or tabling as they called it. They'd drive hundreds of miles to Salt Lake City, Denver, Las Vegas, and other cities. They'd set up tables in front of grocery stores and malls, display photos of happy animals, tell their story, give advice about animal care, and set a coffee can where people could drop a few dollars. It was a daily, penny-counting existence. Their luck changed one day in Los Angeles when Maria Borgel Peterson, the wife of the movie director Wolfgang Peterson, stopped at their table. Moved by Best Friend's mission, she recruited her celebrity friends to publicize the cause and help raise money. In 1992, one of the co-founders with a background in publishing created a magazine with a subscription list and membership fees. Thousands signed up. Then in the summer of 1993, Caroline Marcus, dog walker to the stars, stopped at a table manned by Batista and his future wife, Silva. She worked with them to organize a fundraiser and invite a bunch of A-list celebrities. That fall, Marcus and best friends hosted a benefit at Chateau Marmont, one of the swankiest hotels in town. Batista and his crew were so poor they had to borrow formal wear from their Hollywood acquaintances. "We felt like the Muppets Take L.A.," he recalled. More events followed year after year. "They were at all the best places," Silva Batista said. "The Hollywood Roosevelt, the Hollywood Palladium. One time we had Charlize Theron, Laura Dern, Hilary Swank, and Deborah Messing all at the same event," her husband added a little starstruck. In 1995, Best Friends began holding local Strut Your Mutt adoption events in various cities. In 1999, began an annual super adoption event in L.A. The most recent took place at the Rose Bowl. With donations and grant money coming in, the organizers could feed the animals and continue construction. Each section, Dogtown, Cat World, Horse Haven, Marshall's Piggy Paradise, Bunny House, and Parrot Garden, included multiple buildings and enough outdoor space to make the animals feel stimulated and at ease. They built a wildlife area, a veterinary clinic, and a welcome center, and they purchased a fleet of vans. They also hired more staff, and in 2001 began to hold conferences, spreading their message and confabbing with other shelter leaders on how they could achieve their goal. Then came a tragedy that rocked Best Friends to fame. In 2007, police in Virginia raided the Bad News Kennels, the dogfighting operation co-owned by NFL quarterback Michael Vick. The animals had been horribly abused, run to exhaustion, whipped with chains, starved, shocked, set against each other, and killed if they didn't act aggressively enough. People may have had vague notions about dogfighting, but this case, so extreme and involving a sports star, brought the issue to wide attention. Most people assumed the dogs trained for fighting were too vicious to let live. The Humane Society, among others, recommended they be put down. Best Friends had other ideas, and it took in 20 of the most traumatized animals. A Bay Area pit bull advocacy group took 10 others. The caregivers insisted that these dogs were frightened, not vicious. Under the supervision of Frank McMillan, an expert in animal behavior, Best Friends evaluated each dog and created individual rehabilitation plans. Within weeks, some of them were coming out of their shells, having fun with toys and engaging with people. Michelle Weaver, who managed the project, said, "In the end, 13 dogs were sufficiently rehabbed to be adopted, and 9 lived out their lives at the sanctuary. None of the Bad News rescues that went to the sanctuary had to be killed." National Geographic celebrated the program in Dogtown, a television series about Best Friends. As the Washington Post puts it, "The dogs became ambassadors, tail-wagging proof of what's possible through rescue and rehabilitation. Visiting the sanctuary is like spending time in a national park, with its majestic scenery and rustic-looking buildings. The Welcome Center offers exhibits, trail maps, a desk where you can sign up for tours, and a gift shop. A dirt road winds through the canyon, with pull-ins for the various domains and an award-winning plant-based cafe. Along the way, you'll see volunteers walking dogs or wheeling a trolley with a cat. Some tourists come for adoption, and they get time to hang out and play with their future pet. Each animal arriving at the sanctuary goes through an intake procedure that includes medical examination, vaccination, and any other care it may need, including surgery. It's also spayed or neutered and quarantined to make sure it's free of disease. Then it's evaluated for behavior. Is the creature aggressive, shy? Does it get along with fellow animals and with people? Then it's treated with behavioral protocols, therapy in human terms. It can take weeks, months, or years for an animal to become ready for adoption. If that isn't possible, it lives out its life in a beautiful, low-stress environment. During my few days at the sanctuary, I met Melissa McCormick, a senior manager at Dogtown who has a degree in biopsychology. She worked with an on-site staff of around 30 who care for more than 420 canines, emphasizing social adjustment. "We try to get them in a playgroup," she said. "They bring each new dog to a small solo enclosure next to the larger group pen and watch its body language. If they seem okay, they'll put it with a small pack and a greeter dog, a highly social, low-key animal that's good at making other dogs feel comfortable. A staff member is always present inside the yard." McCormick and her staff favor an approach known among dog trainers as LIMA, least intrusive, minimally aversive. The idea is to reduce fear in an animal that's already stressed out from confinement or abuse. They use a training clicker paired with a treat to identify and reward positive behavior, such as coming when called, or to distract a dog from negative behavior, such as guarding its resources too aggressively. The absence of reward might be enough to discourage negative behavior, or they might use a squirt of water to interrupt it. Staff members enter notes about each animal in a daily log. It's a gradual process whose pace depends on the dog. Sometimes the trainers put a leash on a dog outside the front door and give it a treat simply for staying calm. Days later, they might walk a few feet from the building, letting the dog slowly build confidence that they'll return and eventually go further. When a dog is really comfortable, the staff encourage volunteers to take it for walks or car rides. Gilmore, a chubby tan dog, had been attacked by other dogs at a shelter in New Mexico, and he still wasn't comfortable in a play group. Now he was staying in his own private kennel, an outdoor run. Around humans, he was shy but not terrified. You can pet him briefly, but he doesn't love it, McCormick advised. She and her team were building his confidence with nose work, among other things, hiding his food and letting him feel competent by sniffing it out. As they slowly exposed him to people and other dogs, he was making progress. McCormick said he was adoptable, but he would need a special person, someone who wants a really shy dog. When I visited Cat World, around 550 cats were living in its 11 buildings and outdoor areas. Each cat that needs rehabilitation is assigned a pathway to progress, a series of 30, 60, and 90-day goals, with daily milestones recorded in a logbook. Pipkin, for example, was a well-adjusted tabby who had an aversion to human hands. She'll come up and rub on you, but if you try to touch her with your hand, she'd attack, says Amy Kohlbecker, who was serving as the director of Cat World. Pippin's 30-day goal was simply to allow a human to come near. Her 60-day goal was to allow a trainer to touch her with a plastic hand on a stick. Kohlbecker said they used a fake hand to avoid being bitten and scratched. Eventually, Pipkin reached her 90-day goal, letting someone pet her without a violent reaction. The ultimate goal, getting her adopted to a calm, understanding home. Pipkin was adopted soon after my visit. Another cat, Charlie, had been part of a therapy program in a woman's prison until one day an inmate started kicking her until a guard intervened. That was more than a year before my visit, but Charlie remained traumatized. She expressed it by biting herself on the side until she bled. Charlie wore a plastic recovery cone like the ones you see on dogs after surgery. She loved to be petted and acted like a well-adjusted cat. But the moment the caregivers took off the cone, Kohlbecker told me, Charlie would start biting herself again. We've done every test under the sun to find out if it's a physical issue, Kohlbecker said. It's more psychological now. Despite such cases, Cat World was a cheerful place. There was a house and outdoor space for every category of need. Incontinent cats, cats with neurological problems, rescued ferals, cats with feline leukemia virus, and healthy cats. Most of the animals were available for adoption. Kohlbecker was speaking to me in a room full of healthy adolescent cats when a tour group came in. They melted at the spectacle of kitties scampering over obstacles, running through tunnels, batting around toys, tumbling over each other. Sheer feline cuteness. Within moments, the visitors had cats in their laps. Oh, look at these guys. Oh, Mom, over there, they're so pretty, so precious. I love that black cat. If you fall in love with one of these guys, our adoption specialist will make sure you're well informed about making that decision, said the tour guide. Exotic birds might be the least adoptable creatures at the sanctuary, especially the big parrot species. They're blessed with longevity. Some have lifespans of 50 years or more, and that means they can outlive their owners. And some have difficult behaviors. Cockatoos love to yell. The shrieks can exceed 130 decibels, more than enough to damage your hearing. The bite of some parrot species has a force of more than 300 pounds of pressure per square inch, which can partially sever your finger. These birds are never truly domesticated, said L. Greer, who oversaw Parrot Garden. While dogs and cats have lived with humans for thousands of years, some exotic birds may be only a generation or two removed from the wilderness. You're talking about a wild animal that's extremely intelligent and has some of the most complex social dynamics that we've been able to study, Greer said. Putting these birds in solitary confinement in a cage makes them crazy, she said. At least 10 to 15% of parrots in captivity exhibit self-destructive neurotic behavior. It may take the form of compulsive preening, called barbering or plucking out feathers, or self-mutilation to the point of drawing blood. Many caged birds develop physical ailments such as heart disease and osteoporosis from poor diet, as well as a lack of sunshine and exercise. Some 140 birds live in Parrot Garden in a cluster of indoor and outdoor aviaries. Their screeches are so loud that earplug dispensers are mounted along the walls. Like other trainers, Greer and her colleagues create progress plans for the animals, and they use positive reinforcements and stimulating games to distract the birds from destructive behavior. Matthew, a hybrid macaw, had been surrendered by an elderly woman who could no longer take care of him. He was 2.5 foot festival of colors, blue, yellow, red, and green, with a white face and black pattern rings around his eyes. He arrived with an assortment of symptoms, including seizures that caused him to fall off his perch and lie motionless on the cage floor. He bit without warning, with a force that could cut through a piece of tin. If he was a dog, he would have to be muzzled, Greer said. He was also engaging in feather picking, which his trainers aimed to prevent by giving him toys to distract him. They added stimulation by making him forage for meals by covering his food bowl with shredded newsprint. A strange new experience for a bird that may never have seen shredded paper before. Matthew was lovable in his own way. He was musically inclined, and he liked popular 1990s ballads, especially Whitney Houston songs. He'll sway to the music and go, la, 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 Greer said. It's very cute. But Matthew's seizures and unpredictable biting meant he would be a difficult candidate for adoption. At Horse Haven, I met Emma Dean, a reddish-brown mare who had survived an ordeal. She'd been grazing with her foal on the shores of Lake Powell when a fast-rising water from a record spring runoff trapped them for weeks, water in front of them, cliffs behind. Horses, as prey animals, are naturally skittish. Emma Dean's experience made her doubly so. The foal survived and was adopted. But Jen Reed, senior manager of horses at the sanctuary, knew that Emma Dean's nerves were strung as tight as a fiddle string. For weeks, Reed didn't even enter the pen. She'd drop in the hay for the horse to eat without making eye contact. She'd spent months gradually getting closer to the horse, a step at a time, watching for subtle signs of distress. If she flicked an ear at me, I'd stop my forward progress, Reed said. Eventually, she was able to touch Emma Dean with an 8-foot lunge stick while keeping her distance. Weeks later, stroke her flank. Months after that, slip on a halter. Still later, take her for a walk. Bit by bit, Emma Dean was learning to let go of her fear. When I met Emma Dean, she had been at the sanctuary for 1 year and 8 months. She showed a comfortable body language as we approached. Soft eyes, non-twitchy ears, relaxed mouth. She stood calmly as Reed stroked her face, slipped a rope halter over her head, and walked her around. It's sort of like math, Reed said, explaining the process. You start with 1 plus 1, then 1 plus 2, and you just add complications until eventually you're doing algebra and trigonometry. Best Friends is big, and not just in terms of acreage. In recent years, its annual revenue has been more than $173 million. The society has become a marketing juggernaut with a sophisticated web presence and more than 900 nationwide employees. In 2007, Best Friends began building a national network of like-minded shelters whose staff members help one another. They relieve overcrowding by transporting animals to less crowded shelters and providing equipment technical support. In the 2010s and 2020s, they created a network of centers and programs in Atlanta, Bentonville, Arkansas, Houston, Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, and New York City. They hired hundreds of new employees to support regional health centers, offering veterinary care and management expertise. In 2016, we drew a line in the sand and said, we're going to take this country to no-kill by 2025, Castle told me. We were very interested in pushing the limits of what's considered savable. As Best Friends saw it, no more than 10% of the animals at any given shelter should be beyond saving. Its definition of no-kill meant keeping at least 90% of the animals alive, a goal it pursued with evangelical zeal. Castle hired a tech team to gather data on the nation's public and private animal shelters, nearly 4,000 by their estimates. They created a digital dashboard that shows monthly performance data at the state, county, and individual shelter level. A map is online as well on the wall at the Welcome Center. In 2024, the society developed an algorithm that uses artificial intelligence to predict rising euthanasia rates before they occur, using the area's demographic, economic, and social data. This all serves to identify shelters performing below par in order to pair them with successful shelters or send out a team from Best Friends to help. In 2018, for example, Best Friends sent a team to embed at a shelter in southern Texas. The Palm Valley Animal Society was taking in nearly 40,000 animals per year, but only around 25% made it out alive. Best Friends took over the shelter's management, helping it boost adoptions through better marketing and special programs, returning more lost pets to the original owners, and taking other measures to reduce the kill rate. Within 18 months, we went from euthanizing over 100 animals per day to saving over 90% of them, says Louis Quintanilla, who worked at Palm Valley at the time. He was so impressed that he moved to Utah and became Best Friend's Senior Director of Sanctuary Animal Care. Quintanilla's colleagues pointed me to several other shelters with similar happy outcomes. But some encounters were less smoothly. In order to earn Best Friend's no-kill designation, a shelter must have a 90% save rate, and when a place falls short, it can be labeled pro-kill by the implication. Donors turn away, staff members face stigma, and managers are harassed. There are good leaders, veterinarians, and staff leaving animal welfare entirely due to conflicts related to the arbitrary 90% metric, Levy, the University of Florida shelter medicine expert, said. When Paulette Dean, executive director of an animal shelter in Danville, Virginia, declined Best Friend's offer to step in, the society organized a local pressure campaign with TV commercials, a Facebook page, door-to-door canvassing, and testimony at city council meetings. As Best Friends accused her shelter of poor performance, Dean found herself living in a social media hell of abuse and threats. Katie Fine, a Best Friends representative, said the society never meant for such abuse to take place. The activism did eventually help push the city to give the shelter support to make improvements, but Ken Larking, the city manager, says it happened in a way that caused unnecessary conflict and aggravation. Other communities have reported similar experiences. And that is where we're going to stop on this article today, and we'll pick it up next program. Because we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family, we hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.